State health officials say no coronavirus cases have been found here in Florida.
But the health department is less forthcoming about how many people have been tested.
If we have a case, we should tell people not to frighten them, but you tell them and tell them how to protect themselves.
And a federal court says the state's position on restoring voting rights to former felons is unconstitutional.
This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Florida health officials say they can't release information about how many people have been tested for COVID-19, the coronavirus, what you need to know about the virus and the flu this year, plus the ongoing fight over Amendment 4.
You can join our conversation statewide, 305-995-1800, on the Florida Roundup after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, there have been no cases of the coronavirus reported here in Florida so far. That according to the state's health department. But the state won't talk about how many people have been tested for what's now officially called the COVID-19 virus. Meantime, it is also the peak of flu season, and hundreds of Floridians have died from the flu and pneumonia this year. Here on the Florida Roundup, we're going to be talking about the coronavirus and flu season, and we'll go to your calls in a few minutes. What are your questions and concerns about this? Call us up right now at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, and tweets to @FloridaRoundup.
Justin Sr. is with us, the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Justin also is the former secretary of the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration. That's the state's chief health policy and planning agency. Justin's with us here on the Florida Roundup from WFSU in Tallahassee. Justin, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think the state is being forthcoming enough regarding testing for the coronavirus in Florida?
I think that the state of Florida, the officials generally do an excellent job when it comes to protecting public health and in heading off public health emergencies and in responding to public health emergencies. There's always a difficult balancing that you have to do when it comes to notifying the public and making sure that you're disseminating information that is useful to actually prevent an epidemic from occurring, while at the same time not sowing panic. So I certainly would defer to them because they've exercised excellent judgment in the past.
You've been in those types of rooms before. You're now the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance with more than a dozen hospital networks throughout the state. Should the state be more forthcoming when it comes to testing for coronavirus in order to have more public awareness about what the risk may be?
I think that the key is more educating people about what type of person might have coronavirus and who really needs to be tested. That involves making sure that people understand what the symptoms are of coronavirus and then who is at risk of actually having the coronavirus as opposed to having something with similar symptoms like the flu or mm-hmm. the common cold.
Does releasing testing details or statistics go toward that kind of public awareness?
I'm not sure what purpose that would serve. And again, I would defer to the Department of Health and to the various county health departments that work in the Department of Health in the state of Florida. They do an excellent job at handling this type of emergency and this type of situation. I think it is a difficult call to determine what information needs to be disseminated and what doesn't, but they've exercised excellent judgment historically.
Yeah, so what's the consideration in your experience, Justin, as the former secretary of the ACA, the Florida Healthcare Administration? What are they weighing in terms of public availability of information?
Well, you know, so I have to say, first off, that I was the secretary of the Agency for Healthcare Administration,
right.
and we did have a role when it came to public health. However, the chief public health officer is a counterpart secretary, the secretary of the Department of Health,
mm-hmm.
Who's also known as the Surgeon General. The types of situations where I got involved or had some involvement in the last decade had to do with the Zika virus as well as with two hurricanes, which are some of the hurricanes in particular, probably the most common public health emergency that confronts the state of Florida. you want to make sure that people aren't panicking, that people are not, undergoing mass evacuations. You want to make sure that people don't have the wrong information when it comes to, you know, what they need to do and how they protect themselves and what their risks are. You don't want to unnecessarily make people believe that they have a risk for something where they have little or no risk. At the same time, you want to be frank with people. You don't want to make them feel like they're perfectly safe when in fact they're in danger. So that's really what you're looking at. The goal of this is to, first off, it's an epidemic in another country. You want to make sure that you stop its entry into the United States and into Florida. And barring that, you want to be able to prevent any community-based transmission here. So you don't want it to get a foothold here if in fact you do find a case.
We're speaking with Justin Senior, the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. We're talking about COVID-19, the new official name of the coronavirus. We'll be talking about flu season as well. 305-995-1800 is the phone number, 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup. Justin, you mentioned the Zika virus. Certainly we were familiar with that episode here in South Florida. I'm in Miami. During that outbreak in the summer of 2016, the state health department did release information regarding people being tested for the virus. And on Tuesday of this week, the Florida Surgeon General, Scott Reifkes, appeared before the Senate Healthcare Policy Committee in Tallahassee. He explained why the Zika information was publicly released this way.
Zika was transmitted by mosquitoes. So if there was an individual had Zika in a particular area, it was important for other individuals in the area to know because mosquitoes can fly about 100 yards. This is a situation where it can be only transmitted person to person within a very narrow radius. And also, because there are no individuals with coronavirus currently in the state of Florida, the possibility to spread is not there, which is different than what happened when Zika was present.
Justin, when you became Secretary of the Healthcare Administration in Florida, which was in the months immediately after the Zika outbreak, how did publicly releasing the Zika testing affect public health and healthcare providers?
So at the time that information was released, I was the deputy secretary at the agency. I was what's known as the Medicaid director, so I was in charge of the Medicaid program.
Right, but in October of that year, you became the secretary.
That's right. So what I recall about that, and I think that the distinction that Dr. Reifkes is making, is that there were confirmed cases of Zika virus in the state of Florida at that time. One thing that there are a lot of things that are similar between Zika and coronavirus, and there are some things that are different. The biggest similarity is that it was coming in from abroad, by and large. Most of the cases when it came to Zika were travel related. Mm-hmm. However, when they understood, and this is a key difference, when they understood how Zika was being transmitted, one of the key ways of transmission was a particular type of mosquito, right, which was present in South Florida. And that's a difference. There's no evidence that the coronavirus is spread by mosquitoes. So confirming that there were cases in the state of Florida and that there were a significant number of people being tested was not necessarily information that was going to misinform the public or cause alarm, unnecessary alarm, or anything like that. You really were telling people, in particular with Zika, it affected pregnant women very significantly, and it was very important that people understand that there were cases of Zika in South Florida, that they were in an area where Zika cases had been active and where there were suspected cases of Zika, and they needed to get tested because time was of the essence with respect to their pregnancy, right, and the effects could be so devastating.
Regarding the coronavirus, this COVID-19 now officially named, the state received some testing kits earlier this month. Do you know the state of those testing kits when it comes to the Safety Net hospitals, the hospitals that your organization represents?
I do not know the specific status of those cases. The CDC does a great job, I think, in making sure that hospitals and helping hospitals get prepared for this sort of thing, but I don't know the state of the testing kits.
Because there had some concern about whether or not the testing kits were not legitimate, but were providing legitimate results.
I apologize. I don't know the status of that with the Safety Net hospitals.
Fair enough. Justin, hold on. We're going to continue this conversation here. Justin Senior is with us, the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida.
And certainly the COVID-19 virus, Tom, as you pointed out, that's not the official name for it. It's a concern. But how about this? It's also flu season right now. Dr. John Sennett is chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at the USF Morsani College of Medicine, and he joins us now from WUSF. Dr. Sennett, thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Now, you provided a briefing this week to the State Senate Health Policy Committee on what we know and what we don't know about this virus. But you also made a point of mentioning that here in Florida, people are much more likely to become ill from influenza than the overseas virus. What are the important points you'd like Florida to know about flu season this year?
Well, I would tell you that this is probably the worst flu season in 10 years. If you were to look nationally at the CDC site, they list about 29 million cases of flu in the U.S., 280,000 people hospitalized, and at least 16,000 deaths. And to my mind, these numbers are a little bit understated. I feel that it's a very significant threat. I'm not alone in those feelings. When this is over, COVID-19 may or may not be a problem. We don't know. But right now, I would identify influenza sort of as the elephant in the room. We're used to it. We know about it. And sometimes we get too relaxed about it. We think it's just a cold, and it's not.
Sure. People, as you said, die in large numbers every year from the flu, but because it's something that comes around every year, we don't see the same level of alarm or concern. You recommend that everyone get a flu shot and then also just take common sense precautions. Wash your hands. Stay home from work or school if you feel sick so you don't contaminate anyone else. These are common sense things, right, that doctors like you point out every flu season, but not enough people take your advice.
Well, I think people in general are becoming much more aware of influenza. Our vaccination rates are up. It remains a serious systemic disease. I think this year is a very important year. I think nationally and in the state, we're much more aggressively trying to protect people against influenza. We've matched the vaccine better to the circulating strains of virus. In other words, some years we've had less than 30% protection, I believe. This year it's probably 70. All of the vaccines now are what's called quadrivalent, which means they protect against four different strains of flu. In the past, you could get a vaccine that just protected against three. This year, all vaccines are grown in cells, so people allergic to eggs don't have to worry about getting vaccinated. We have a new flu treatment out, baloxavir, also known as Afluza. It's a single pill. It's highly effective against non-hospitalized patients. I think we're moving ahead in the battle against flu, but it remains a treacherous adversary.
Right. People underestimate that it can be deadly. Now, as you pointed out, both here on this program just now and also to state lawmakers this week, influenza is a bigger threat, a bigger public health threat. However, the coronavirus or COVID-19 is also more contagious and more deadly. It can spread to more people. More people infected with it will die as compared to those who come down with the flu. Can you share a little bit more about that aspect of this public health matter that you presented in Tallahassee this week?
Well, sure. The COVID-19 is an unknown quantity. Okay, we don't know a lot about it. It's a new virus. We think it somehow made its way from bats to pangolin, which is a kind of Asian anteater, and from there to people in what is called a wet market in Wuhan, China. This probably occurred around December 10th. A physician in China, Dr. Li, noticed an increase in cases of pneumonia and wondered if it might have been SARS. He has since succumbed to the disease and has become a national hero in China for trying to warn people. To me, as an epidemiologist, I think it's about 50-50 whether China will be able to contain it or not. If it's
50-50,
They may not be able to control it.
That's not encouraging.
No, it's the scenario becomes troubling if it breaks out of China and ends up especially in countries like India or continents like Africa that don't have sophisticated or as sophisticated healthcare systems. So if it affects more than one continent, for instance, two continents, it's considered a pandemic.
Right.
Then the race is on for a vaccine and treatment, and that race has already started.
Now, you also spoke about your concern that people not panic, that there's a lot of misinformation out there when it comes to learning about COVID-19 or any disease. Can you expand a little bit on that? Because there's a lot of rumor and speculation about the spread of this disease. Where are reliable sources, in your view, that people should look to?
Well, I think that's perhaps the most important question of the interview. I am deeply troubled by the role of fake news in this very important epidemic situation. Just last night, I saw on CNN, one of the scientists thought it came from a meteorite. Other people think it comes from biologic research laboratories. None of this is true. It originated in the wet market. Coronaviruses are known to mutate and go from animals to people. That's what's going on. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And so you have asked folks to look at the Centers for Disease Control website or even World Health Organization data on the state of Florida website to learn more about this. And let me ask you the same question Tom Hudson asked Mr. Senior. What are your thoughts about the Florida Health Department not being forthcoming, critics say, about the testing they're doing here in this state for COVID-19?
I strongly agree with the Department of Health's stance, and there's a reason for that. The vast majority of what you might call people of interest or people that are being worried about are not going to have the disease on testing, okay? In the meanwhile, for 2 weeks, they're stigmatized. They might not be able to go to work. Friends might not visit. They might be shunned on the street. There are no cases in Florida. I don't think it's appropriate or fair to people that might, and I just think might, have a medical condition to tell the community that that's what's going on. Unlike Zika, Zika is spread by mosquitoes. So it makes sense to tell someone there's Zika in your neighborhood. And then the first thing you do is go in your backyard and look for pool standing water to get rid of mosquitoes and things like that. But this COVID-19 is spread by droplets that you cough up. It's spread by shaking hands, by contact, and probably some fecal-oral route. But this would not be comparable to Zika as a public health issue.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about coronavirus or COVID-19 testing here in Florida. It's also flu season. What are your thoughts and questions? Lots of calls waiting. You can join the queue. Call us up right now here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, as we speak with public health officials about how to contain disease in this state. We want your tweets too. Send them to @FloridaRoundup. A quick break, and then you join the conversation from wherever you happen to be in the state. We want to hear from you. Lots of people waiting. We will get to you in just a moment as we continue the conversation. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We are talking about the flu and the coronavirus, two separate diseases, of course. There are no coronavirus COVID-19 cases in the state of Florida, according to the Department of Health. The flu, however, we are at the height of flu season, one of the worst in 10 years, according to Dr. John Sennett, the chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of South Florida. He's our guest in Tampa. Justin Sr. is the CEO of Safety Net Hospital Alliance in Florida, a network of more than a dozen hospital networks, public hospitals and other hospitals throughout the state. 305-995-1800. Our phone line is open. Your questions about the flu, concerns about influenza, 305-995-1800. We'll begin in Miami Lakes with Robert on line one. Go ahead, Robert. Thanks for holding. You're on the radio.
Good afternoon. My question is regarding ports of entry. We know that the airports, there's no current flights, right, from China to the United States, as far as I understand. But what about, we have cargo ships that come in with crew. And, is this another point that's being controlled in any way, shape, or form? And how would we be able to know if there is some kind of contamination from these particular individuals?
Sure, Robert, we got it. Thanks for that question. Dr. Sennett, let me just ask you, from a public health standpoint, we know that in January, CDC and the federal government did put in some assessment facilities, or activated some assessment facilities at airports. How effective are those? And what about marine ports for cargo?
Well, I think Robert has asked some very valid, intelligent questions. Number one, related to cargo, this virus can survive outside the human body a day or two. It's not going to survive a trip from Asia. So cargo is not an issue. When crew of a foreign vessel dock, almost uniformly, they do not have visas to enter the United States, and they must remain on the ship. They cannot leave the containment area of the port. So I'm not especially worried about the port being a way the virus gets in. Airports are a real threat in that there's huge amounts of people going through, and they're all crowded on one another. The United States has designated 7 airports as ports of entry. Mm-hmm. They have thermometry there. If you look at an airport line, and we've all tragically been involved in those, you have these lines that snake back and forth. Well, the reason for that is, one, to get very good pictures of people boarding the aircraft in case something goes wrong, but also many of those lines incorporate thermometry, infrared thermometry, and they can identify people with fevers for further investigation. Hmm. That technology is quite advanced. It's been used in Asia for years. I have a great deal of confidence in it. Additionally, we use screening questionnaires. In other words, have you been in Wuhan? And personal questions, have you had a cough or fever? Or have you taken any medications that might reduce a fever in case someone, took Tylenol mm-hmm. or something of that mm-hmm. nature?
Yeah.
305-995-1800. What are your questions about COVID-19? That's the new official name for coronavirus, and also flu season. William is in Miami. Hey, William, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I have first a comment and then a question. The comment is that I've noticed that we've been receiving a lot of national, international information, better said, up to right to the point that this show started. We only heard that China had 75,000 cases. So thank you for covering domestically and even more so here in Florida. It's a mm-hmm. big help. I went on the WHO website yesterday, and there are cases here in the United States. That being said, that leads into the question, which is, my understanding is that the passengers that were on the cruise ship that were tested positive and others were in quarantine are in quarantine at this point for 2 weeks. Although my general understanding about some viruses is that it could take more than 2 weeks before symptoms show. My question is, how long is the quarantine period? Has any of this been updated, and how does it affect those that are in quarantine and the potential of the release in terms of whether it's safe or not to release them out, and at what point of time would that be? Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, William. Great questions from William in Miami. Justin Senior, CEO of Safety Net Hospital Alliance in Florida. You know, I learned yesterday that when doing a segment on coronavirus, that quarantine actually referred to 40 days. It was, I believe, Italian seafaring captain's word for keeping someone with scurvy or some other disease isolated from the rest of the crew for 40 days, that was seen as the amount of time necessary for a virus to pass. So kind of an interesting backstory to this. What about William's question, in particular when it comes to cruise ship passengers? Of course, here in Florida, we've got a lot of cruise ships coming in and out. What about William's question?
Well, I think, the key here is communication between the CDC, the Florida Department of Health, and the county health departments, as well as healthcare providers out there, in terms of disseminating information that's specific to this virus and understanding this virus. When you listen to the key public health officials, it appears that the average incubation period for this particular virus, I believe, is around 6 days. Dr. Rivkes, the Surgeon General, testified to the Florida Senate earlier. It can be a little bit shorter than that. It could be longer, but that is the average. And I believe that the 14 days is not something that was pulled randomly. 14 days is the amount of time where if you are not showing any symptoms and not testing positive, that they can feel comfortable that once you're 14 days past any exposure, that you're almost certainly not going to have the virus. And that's why that number was chosen.
Justin, I'm wondering, in some of the public safety net hospitals in the area where there are significant cruise passengers coming in and out, have you heard or any additional communication from those safety net hospitals regarding any kind of preparations they may be making? Now, these cruise ships, of course, are not coming to and from China, Japan, and Asia. These are cruise ships that usually start and stop at these ports in Florida, but certainly the cruise industry is under a bit of scrutiny here.
Yeah, the hospitals are all preparing for this, and that wouldn't just, I mean, that would be true of all hospitals around the state, and it's a matter of making sure that you have good communication with your local county health department as well as with the State Department of Health, and you're keeping up to date on what the CDC is advising. All of the hospitals would be preparing by putting up additional signage for people that come in so that they could self-identify if they are truly at risk for coronavirus. And that would mean that they're showing the symptoms and that they either have been to China, this particular mm-hmm. province in China, or China generally, or in close contact with someone that has been in China, to make sure that they identify themselves. They also want to train their staff to make sure that they're very quickly asking the right questions to try to get that information out of them, because they would be going through discussions, tabletop exercises, as well as demonstrating their facility with these things when it comes to making sure that once you've identified a person of interest that may have the coronavirus, that you keep them away from other patients. So you're trying to quickly identify them. You're trying to make sure that you protect the other patients and protect any visitors at the hospital. You're trying to protect your own healthcare personnel and tell them what mm-hmm. they need to do. And you're trying to make sure you can keep the patient, treat the patient and keep them comfortable.
Let's take another phone call from South Florida in Miami. Lynn on line 8. Lynn, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, just a quick comment. I teach in a public school, and we've had quite an outbreak of students with influenza in the last week. And an interesting thing is that the students say that there is no soap typically in the bathrooms at school. And I know this is the case in many public schools. What role does hand washing play in the spread of virus, coronavirus, or typical influenza? And would it help if the schools made sure that the bathrooms were stocked with soap? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Lynn. Dr. Sennett, we'll put that to you. And have you stopped shaking hands during flu season and instead bump elbows with folks?
I do often bump elbows. I'm troubled to hear that there's not soap in the bathrooms. That doesn't seem to be a very good public health measure to me. Soap should be readily available. This disease is very easily, and I'm talking about influenza, but actually COVID-19 as well, are readily spread from hand-to-hand contact and even occasionally from inanimate objects. I would go beyond that and say not only should there be soap available, but perhaps similar to a hospital because of the crowding of kids and stuff, maybe some temporary use of alcohol sanitizers in the hallway, something of that nature, encourage children or students to do that. But a good way, the way I protect myself is I wash my hands constantly.
Good advice, especially at this time of year. Listen to the doctor on this one. 305-995-1800 to join us here on the Florida Roundup. Calls from all over the state now coming in. Joseph is in Apopka. Hey, Joseph, what are your thoughts about this?
Hi, good afternoon. So my question is regarding the comment that people are being screened for fever at ports of entry. Okay, that's good. However, I have heard that there is possibly a two-week period where someone could be infected and contagious and not have fever or any other symptoms. So that's pretty alarming. So I'm wondering, my question is that true? And if so, are there any other ways that we can screen people to see if they are in fact infected?
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. That's Joseph in Apopka. Justin Sr., Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. You talked about the incubation period, I believe, a minute ago, but what about his question? And also, are there other ways to screen people coming in at ports of entry, or could there be?
I think that might be a better question for the doctor. I do think you can have asymptomatic cases of coronavirus, and it can be asymptomatic for some period of time, but he might have quite a bit more information.
Dr. Sennett, why don't we close this segment out with your final thoughts and answering Joseph's question as well.
Joseph, an intelligent question. The incubation period of this is 5.7 days. I'm in contact almost every night with my colleagues in China, who we work closely with, to try to get a better handle on this. We don't, because of government cutbacks, three important programs have been closed. One is PREDICT. The other is the Pandemic Preparedness Program, and the CDC footprint internationally has been reduced from 49 countries to 10. As a result, we don't have all the information we need. There's a general feeling when I talk to Chinese doctors and other American infectious disease doctors that we're going to find that a fair amount of this disease is actually mild. When you have just a few test kits and 2,000 people a day show up in your emergency room, it's hard to deal with the x-rays and all that. So I think the death rate will actually be lower. Asymptomatic carriage will be found. People with mild disease will be found. And when you look at people that die, with exception, of course, most have an underlying disease, either heart disease, diabetes, or lung disease. Does that help? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, certainly. And PREDICT, you mentioned that program. That program was closed. It focused its efforts on finding dangerous animal viruses that could infect humans, which is we're given to understand how COVID-19 spread. And such great insights from both of you. Wash your hands, everybody. Get the flu shot. Check reliable sources of information. All great advice here from Dr. John Sennett, chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at the USF Morsani College of Medicine, and Justin Senior, CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
This week, a federal appeals court ruled it is unconstitutional to require released felons in Florida to pay their fines and fees before registering to vote. Now, the ruling that came out applies only to the 17 people who sued the state over the implementation of Amendment 4, but it is a court win for the effort to restore voting rights to hundreds of thousands of released felons here in Florida. Danny Rivero has been covering this story from the get-go. He's with us in our studios in Miami with WLRN. So what did the appeals court judges decide this week, Danny?
The appeals court basically upheld what the district-level court said. And just to summarize that, they agreed with the lower court and they said you can't stop someone from voting if they are actually unable to pay the money that they owed. The original court said that, and this court came in with really what looked like a stronger opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And they said this is unconstitutional. This is discrimination based on someone's wealth, because you could have the same person committed the same crime and their ultimate right to vote, which they do declare is a right, is different because someone who has the access and the means and the resources who can pay for it will get the right to vote, and someone who doesn't won't.
And the reaction from the governor's office was pretty swift when this appeals court ruling came out.
It was very swift. I think it was within the hour. They said that they're going to appeal it. Basically, this appeals court level decision was handled by a panel of three judges. They want the entire appellate court to look at it, which is 21 judges total, including two of them from the Florida Supreme Court, which moved up into the appeals court.
Right, who had been appointed to the Florida Supreme Court by Governor DeSantis, and then they got promoted, so to speak, when there were openings at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals based in Atlanta. Why does this ruling apply only to the 17 named plaintiffs, though, as opposed to the, over a million felons that Amendment 4 could apply to?
So the quick answer to that is... this was always a temporary measure. There is an ongoing federal court case, and there's these 17 plaintiffs who the court has already declared they're unable to pay for what they owe. We haven't had a trial yet.
Right.
There's a trial scheduled right now for April in Tallahassee, and the judge, as a temporary solution to this, after declaring that they are unable to pay this, said, okay, only the plaintiffs in this case, only the people buying this, should be able to vote. Strictly kept it to those 17.
Will these 17 be able to vote in the March 17th primary?
They will be able to.
We're talking about Amendment 4 and the continued court cases around the implementation of the restoration of the right to vote for felons in Florida. 305-995-1800. That's our phone number. Do you have questions? Do you have an experience here? Would you like to share it with us? 305-995-1800. More coming up from the Florida Roundup. We're back here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, we're talking about this week's federal appeals court ruling on Florida's Amendment 4. That's the constitutional amendment overwhelmingly approved by you, the Florida voters, back in 2018. It restored the right to vote for people with a previous felony conviction if they completed all terms of their sentence. But after Amendment 4 passed, the legislature and the governor approved a law saying that all terms included fines, fees, and restitution, meaning completing the prison term wouldn't be enough to regain the right to vote. But now the appeals court says that law is unconstitutional, that essentially a citizen's inability to pay fines and fees should not prevent them from voting. What do you think about this latest twist in the Amendment 4 saga? 305-995-1800 tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Betty Riddle is one of the 17 plaintiffs who joined this lawsuit around Amendment 4, and she joins us now. Betty, thanks for being with us. And what's your reaction, first off, to the federal appeals court ruling on this?
Oh, very exciting. I was had a little, you know, I had a little worry there, but I was very confident in my attorney, so I'm really excited. Really am. I have never voted in my life. This will be the first time, so.
Wow. So your first time will be in the Florida primary March 17th?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. And tell us your story. What were you convicted of? How did you end up being part of this lawsuit?
Well, I became on, I was adjudicated as an adult at 17. And then I was in and out of prison through a drug addiction that I had. And when I got out, I wanted to change my life, and I went back to college. I got my associate degree as a paralegal, and I started working here at the public defender for Larry Eager. And I ran into someone from the UCLA, Susan Nylon. And at that point, she introduced me and told me about how they've been fighting for the last 10 years to get our rights back to vote. And I told her about my story, and I started speaking everywhere. And then one day, I got a call from an attorney out of New York wanting to know, allow her to represent me in this lawsuit. And I've been speaking, and I've been on board, and I'm a voice for everyone, every former felon.
And, you know, as we learned a minute ago, you and the 16 other plaintiffs will be able to vote in the primary. There are more than a million other people in the state with a previous felony conviction who had been looking forward to voting. I think you referenced the ACLU a minute ago, had been working on restoring rights and then filing this latest lawsuit. I guess the question a lot of these folks have is, now that the federal appeals court has ruled that the state law demanding that fines and fees be repaid is unconstitutional, can all of these other people cast a ballot? That, you know, that's something the supervisors of elections around the state will be dealing with in a few weeks, right?
Yes. Like, I don't understand why it was just 17 of us. I really don't know. But like I say, I'm still, you know, speaking. I'm still on board, and I'm going to fight to the end for everyone. Everyone, every former felon should be entitled to vote. We paid our dues to society. So I'm still fighting, whether I vote or not. I'm the voice, like I said, for everyone.
And let's bring back in Danny Rivera, who has been covering this. Here's a tweet about Amendment 4 saying, it's ridiculous that it only covers the 17. So, Danny, what should the other 1.5 million people following this and have a real stake in this here in Florida? What should their next steps be? Will they be able to vote if they have not paid all fines and fees?
In the immediate term, that is a complicated question. In the long term, what we have with these two court decisions at this point, it points to some momentum to the arguments that are being presented by people like Betty and by the ACLU that that denying the right to vote to people who legitimately can't pay is unconstitutional. There's something to clarify here. The court didn't say it's unconstitutional to make people pay. It said it's unconstitutional when someone legitimately can't pay. And mm-hmm. and that is the only thing that stops them from voting.
Well, and where does it go from here? Of course, we learned that the governor has already announced he intends to appeal this latest appeals court ruling.
So I'll tell you a little of what should happen in an ideal world and what's actually happening. What should happen, what the original judge said, is he put it back to the state and the state legislature. And he said, look, you have real deficiencies here. You guys need to create some kind of a process so that people can figure out and they can clarify that they can't pay this money that they owe. And then if you find that they legitimately can't pay, then you need to give them the right to vote. The legislature has said very clearly at this point that they're not going to touch it. They're not going to come up with any kind of process of that sort that the court asked them prescriptively to come up with. And what we're hearing from the state legislature and lawmakers is they're going to wait it out. They're going to wait for any lawsuits to totally get settled, which this could go all the way up to the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, I'm wondering
about the federal Supreme Court.
The United States Supreme Court. Betty, what are you hearing from the ACLU and your lawyers? Are you prepared to take this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, I have. They keep in contact with me daily on what's going on, and we have discussed it, and wherever they want me to be, I'll be. It doesn't matter. I'm going to fight to the end.
We're talking about Amendment 4 and the constitutional language that Florida voters added to the Florida Constitution to restore the right to vote for felons, and the implementation legislation the legislature passed thereafter, which has tied up these questions in court, meaning what does it mean to complete a sentence? Do all the fines, fees, and restitution, is that included in that definition? 305-995-1800 as you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. David and Davey is up first in Broward County. Go ahead, David. You're on the radio.
Hi. My question is, why doesn't we just get a number, and why don't we just raise the money? Why doesn't the Democratic Party just raise the money and pay for it, since they're the ones that are probably going to benefit from all these people having their rights restored?
David, you're talking about the money in terms of the amount of fines that the released felons still owe in Florida.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Danny, do we know what that number is?
No, that's one of the fundamental problems with this, is that the state record keeping is so decentralized and so sloppy. Some of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit can't even verify how much money they owe. Do you have the either the state or the local government saying you owe money, and then they're unable to find out how much exactly they owe? I mean, we know ballpark, it's probably over $1 billion owed by people across the state, but we don't. I mean, it's almost impossible in some jurisdictions for someone to actually go and figure out what they owe, especially for cases you're talking about cases going back to the 60s and in the 70s. And, you know, a lot of these records are lost. Technically, according to the state, this money is still owed and that they should pay it up. But at the same time, there's no way to find out what's even owed in the first place.
And, you know, to answer David's call question, there have been grassroots efforts online to help people pay some of these fines and fees. Betty, what are your thoughts about what he said, too, that it's perceived that Amendment 4 would primarily benefit the Democratic Party? Of course, voting rights shouldn't be a partisan issue, but like so many other issues, this is being seen through a political lens. What are your thoughts about that?
Okay, when I first found out that after I registered to vote, I found out about the court costs and fines. But when I registered to vote, they only stated that your restitution had to be paid. And then I didn't realize at the time that, you know, I had all these outstanding fines. So once I did contact the clerk of court and went over there, and my record go back to 1975, it was so many people that, I mean, it just fell off. It purged and fell off. So it's therefore I couldn't find out the total amount I owed because it was so old. And then I had one out of Tampa, out of Hillsborough, that doesn't exist. But I knew I had it, but it's like they can't find it. So a lot of us went in there knowing we owed, but when we tried to find it, it was like you couldn't find it. It was non-existent. So how could you pay if you don't know the amount you owe?
Exactly. I think that your case is probably why you were one of the plaintiffs chosen.
Just to hop in here, the original judge that issued the ruling in the district court, Robert Hinkle, he called this an administrative nightmare created by the state because of these exact problems.
Yeah. And you know, and as I said, you know, it shouldn't be a partisan issue, but it certainly has become one. That said, Betty, you'll be casting your ballot in March. And as you said, it's the first time in your life you will have had the opportunity to do that. So that'll be a big day for you.
Yes, I'm going to be the first one there because I'm going to have a sign that says I'm the first one there and the first time voter. So I will be the first person there with a sign. I will vote.
You're going to actually vote on primary day on the 17th, not do an absentee ballot, Betty?
No, I'm not. I'm going to get me a reclining chair, and I'm going to sit out there to the open. I'll be the first one.
You're going to go into the booth, maybe wait in line, and go through the whole process.
Go through the experience. Yes. Get there early.
Old-fashioned way, yeah.
Yes, I am.
Well, Betty, thanks for spending your time and sharing your story with us. Betty Riddle is along with us, one of the 17 plaintiffs that sued the state of Florida over the implementation of Amendment 4, the restoration of voting rights for felons here in Florida. She is with us on the telephone. And Danny Rivero, who's been following this really from the voting here through and onto the federal court and possibly the full appeals court at this point, the 11th Circuit. Danny Rivero, reporter with us here at WLRN in Miami.
Thank you both for being with us, and that is our show today. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Alexander Gonzalez producing this week as well. Jason Zabka, the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, and our technical director, the WLRN Director of Radio Operations, is Peter Mertz. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon. Let's round up then.